You're listening to RTE Lyric Live with the National Symphony Orchestra.
Die Drei Groschen Oper, the Threepenny Opera. Not so much an opera as a play with music created in 1928 by the poet Bertolt Brecht and the composer Kurt Weill. 5 years after it premiered in Berlin, the Threepenny Opera had been translated into 18 languages and clocked up 10,000 performances across Europe. And that was just the start. It then took America by storm and had a lasting influence on some of its leading music theatre composers. Brecht and Weill were two quite different people. Their relations were stormy, to say the least. The cast members were remarkable in themselves, especially the young star Lotte Lenya, and the political atmosphere at the time got increasingly volatile. The story behind the Threepenny Opera is just as colourful as the music itself.
Und weil sie doch so billig sein sollte, dass nur Bettler sie bezahlen können, heißt sie die Drei-Groschen-Oper.
The overture to the Threepenny Opera, performed in public for the very first time at Berlin's Theater am Schiffbauerdamm on the 31st of August 1928, with Theo McCabin conducting the Lewis Ruth Band, a versatile bunch of musicians. Seven strong, they played a total of 23 instruments. And before anyone sings a note, that's already a great introduction to the sound world of its young composer, Kurt Weill, a man who'd had a firm grounding in the German classical system of training, as the Bach-like fugue played by saxophone, piano and the rest at the heart of that overture makes clear. Weill's father had been the chief cantor at the synagogue in Dessau. He'd learnt music from a young age and went to Berlin to study with Ferruccio Busoni and others. An early career in the opera house and theatre saw him collaborating with the great expressionist playwright Georg Kaiser. And in 1922, he joined the November Group, a group of left-wing artists that included Hans Eisler and Stefan Volpe. To make ends meet at this time, Weill took on a range of odd jobs, such as teaching music theory to the young Claudio Arrau, bizarrely, and writing a weekly column on music and culture. But the success of his partnership with Brecht meant he could leave all that behind. Weill had first worked with Brecht the previous year on the Mahagoni Songspiel, an earthy mixture of grand opera and pop music, cabaret and jazz, setting five of his pre-existing poems to music. This was first performed at the Baden-Baden Festival of New Music in 1927 with the young Lotte Lenya in the role of Jessie. The following year, in the improbably idyllic surroundings of Le Lavandou in the south of France, the two men spent May and June working on their first proper collaboration. It was a remake of The Beggar's Opera by John Gay and Johann Christoph Pepusch, which 2 centuries before had been a runaway theatrical success in Georgian London, poking fun at the excesses of Handelian opera and giving audiences a glimpse of what was normally brushed over in polite society, the seamier side of urban life with its prostitutes, thieves, prisons and hangings, and the general corruption and deceit right across society. As Peacham puts it in the 18th century original, through all the employments of life, each neighbour abuses his brother, whore and rogue they call husband and wife. All professions berogue one another. Brecht and Weill updated the action only slightly to Victorian times. Its key characters are, once again, Jonathan Jeremiah Peacham, who runs a shop where he trains up beggars in return for a cut of their earnings, and MacHeath, otherwise known as Mackie Messer, Mac the Knife. When the Peachams learn that their daughter Polly has married MacHeath, they devise a plan to ruin him. MacHeath in that first Berlin production was played by the actor Harald Paulsen, who had his own ideas about how to play the part which didn't necessarily agree with Brecht's. He had strong views about everything. Paulsen wanted to appear in an over-the-top costume including a blue bow tie, but Brecht managed to slap a veto on that. However, just before the production opened, Paulsen held the creative team to ransom by insisting they write a new number about him to help establish his character. And so it was, at the 11th hour, that one of the greatest music theatre songs of the 20th century was born. Brecht and Weill wrote it not for MacHeath himself, but for a street singer to sing, as though it were a penny dreadful, a piece of cheap and gory fiction to entertain the masses, or, as the Germans call it, a Moritette. As the first song in the show, it warns the audience about what to expect from MacHeath, who's always around when someone gets robbed or murdered, but who you can never quite pin things on. He's like a shark, but even worse. In the original German version, this is Mac the Knife.
Zuerst hören Sie eine Moritat über den Räuber Mackies, genannt Mackie Messer. Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne und die trägt auf und war geschändet. Mackie welches war dein
You can hear from that where Weill's musical world was coming from, with strong strains of cabaret and jazz, as well as European opera, and music that keeps returning to the sixth chord that Weill almost could call his own. And as for what Brecht was trying to achieve, well, this is one of the first works in which he uses his technique of epic theatre, in which he deliberately seeks to keep the audience's emotions at bay. He didn't want his audiences to get lost in the drama and blindly sympathise with the leading character. He wanted them to remain objective and see all sides of the story from a detached point of view. And the brusque and clipped tone of Kurt Weill's music also plays an important part in this, with emotion very much kept at arm's length. Back to the action of the Threepenny Opera now. Macheath might be under threat from Peacham, but he does have one powerful ally, the police chief Tiger Brown. The two men have been friends for years, and they reminisce about the good times they used to have back in their army days in this next number, the Cannon Song.
In der Erinnerung an ihre gemeinsame Jugendzeit singen der Räuber Mackies und der Polizeipräsident Brown den Kanonensong.
In developing the storyline of the Threepenny Opera, Bertolt Brecht drew on a wide range of literary sources. One important one is the Bible, funnily enough. Brecht quotes from it frequently. In the opening scene in which Peacham talks about arousing sympathy for his beggars, in a typically cynical way. As Peacham says, the Bible has four or five sayings that stir the heart. Once a man has expended them, there's nothing for it but starvation. Brecht's other sources range from the medieval French poet François Villon through to Rudyard Kipling. But the inspirations weren't always his own work. He always had a circle of people around him during the rehearsal period who he'd encouraged to chip in with suggestions and ideas, some of which found their way into the final show. The title, the Threepenny Opera itself, didn't even come for Brecht. It was probably the playwright Leon Feuchtwanger who thought it up. But as a Berlin acquaintance put it, who can deny that Brecht steals? But he steals with genius. The rehearsal period was chaotic by all accounts. There were disagreements, cast changes, and a dress rehearsal that dragged on till 5 a.m. The final straw came when the programmes came back from the printers with Lotte Lenya's name missing. This even made the normally unflappable Kurt Weill blow a fuse. She was the show's most enduring and unusual performer, a dancer who became an actress and then a singer, first appearing in the role of Jenny in the Threepenny Opera. But as time went on, she grabbed one of the other characters' songs for herself, Pirate Jenny or Seeräuber Jenny. We hear it in a recording that Lenya made much later in the 1950s. This song was originally meant for Macheath's young wife Polly Peacham to sing. She's furious that her parents are trying to interfere in her marriage and is fantasising about having revenge on them. Her song outlines something like a Clark Kent scenario. Pirate Jenny is a quiet barmaid who cleans glasses and makes beds in a seedy hotel, but dreams of being in charge of a pirate ship with 8 sails and 50 cannons. One day it will sail into town, the crew will run onto land, clap everyone in irons and ask her which of the prisoners should be killed, and she'll answer all of them.
Lied eines kleinen Abwaschmädchens in einer Vierpenny-Kneipe, genannt Jenny, die Seeräuberbraut.
Schiff mit 8 Segeln
I've mentioned Lotte Lenya. What about the other members of that original 1928 cast? The role of Peachum was played by Erich Ponto. He was born in the North German coastal city of Lübeck as the son of a merchant and started to study pharmacy at the University of Munich while taking drama lessons on the side. He was a member of the Dresden Theatre Company for 30 years and later found favour with the Nazis. They made him a Staatsschauspieler in 1938, the highest possible title that an actor could have in Nazi Germany. And in the post-war years, he appeared as the Doctor in Carol Reed's film The Third Man. Kurt Geron played Tiger Brown, and fate didn't treat him nearly so kindly. Born into a wealthy Jewish family in Berlin, he studied medicine before turning to acting and working with the great director Max Reinhardt in 1920. His big movie break came in 1930 when he appeared in the role of Kiepert, the magician, in The Blue Angel, opposite Marlene Dietrich. After the Nazis came to power, Geron left Germany for Amsterdam but refused to leave Europe. When Holland was occupied in the Second World War, Geron was sent to the Theresienstadt concentration camp, along with many other Jewish musicians and artists, and then on to Auschwitz, where he died in the gas chambers. And Harald Paulsen, who, as I mentioned earlier, was the original MacHeath, was a major film actor, appearing in 125 movies between 1920 and 1954. He had a fine singing voice too, as we can hear from this original cast recording. Here he is, singing the Ballad of Pleasant Living at terrific speed.
Hören Sie jetzt, wie Herr MacHeath über die Annehmlichkeiten des Lebens denkt. Da preist man mir das Leben großer Geister, das lebt mit einem Buch und nichts im Magen, in einer Hütte daran Ratten nagen. Warst du arm und einsam, weiß und kühl, jetzt machst du mit der Größe aber Schluss. Dann löst sich ganz von selbst das Glücksproblem. Nur wer im Wohlstand lebt, lebt angenehm.
That first production of the Throppany Opera ran for nearly 5 years until the rise of the Nazis made it impossible to continue. 2 weeks after the Reichstag fire of 27th of February 1933, Kurt Weill packed just a very few belongings and left for Paris, hoping that his stay would be a temporary one. But 2 years later, he continued on to the United States, where he began a second career as a composer of Broadway musicals. It also meant he could be reunited with his estranged wife, Lotte Lenya. As Weill later remembered, Lenya and I came here in 1935 and fell immediately in love with this country. And my success here, which people usually subscribe to luck, is mostly due to the fact that I took a very positive and constructive attitude towards the American way of life and the cultural possibilities in this country. Despite his success on Broadway, Weill remained an outsider in America, always in the fringes of the musical establishment, and right up to his death, he was denied membership of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Lotte Lenya's career was also in the doldrums until Weill died in 1950. Soon afterwards, an adaptation of the Throppany Opera was conducted by Leonard Bernstein in a concert version at Brandeis University before transferring to the Theatre de Lys off-Broadway in 1954, featuring Lotte Lenya in the role she premiered in Berlin all those years before. More theatre and television roles followed, as well as the film part for which she's probably best remembered, the role of Rosa Klebb in the Bond film From Russia with Love. She died eventually in 1981. To mark the centenary of her birth in 1898, the Kurt Weill Foundation for Music established an annual Lotte Lenya competition to recognise singers just like her, actors who could put over a song with the right dramatic intention. Not that Lotte Lenya's own singing technique was ever anything to write home about, and especially not in her later years. By the 50s, she'd taken to singing Kurt Weill's music in a much lower register, and one critic memorably described her voice as an octave below laryngitis. But it was her performance that mattered. When she was asked about her long-standing connection with performing Kurt Weill's music just before she died, she said, "There is no tradition. I am the tradition."
You're listening to RTE Lyric Live with the National Symphony Orchestra.